This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
The latest issue of the Historical Society magazine, the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society magazine, is out. It's volume 66. And it is now available. You can pick up a copy at the Historical Society downtown, conveniently located right on Lee Park in the old post office, historic post office building. Is it the post office or was it the library? I can't remember.
Library.
It was the library. Oh, shame on me. The library was the post office. That's why I get confused. The new, what is now the library was the post office. What is now the Historical Society was the library. one of the leadoff article in here, which is fantastic with lots of terrific archival photographs, is written by Daniel Bluestone. He teaches architectural history and directs the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Virginia. The article is Charlottesville Skyscrapers, 1919 to 1929, Ego, Imagination, and Electricity in a Historic Landscape. It's an honor to welcome back to the program Dan Bluestone. How are you, Dan?
Hey, Corey. I'm doing great.
Thanks for coming in.
I'm happy to be here.
So give us the background on the article first. What are you working on when you realize, hey, I got an article I can do here about Charlottesville?
Well, Coy, this is the situation. I've spent most of my life as a historian of architecture and urbanism in Chicago, Illinois, and the skyscraper is absolutely central to Chicago's urban and architectural history. It's a pioneer city for that. And a lot of the discussion about skyscrapers in Chicago is how the city was hemmed in on three sides by water, the Chicago River, Lake Michigan, the South Branch of the Chicago River, and that was what led builders and developers to explore skyscraper technology, skyscraper form, as the city expanded in the late 19th century.
To go up because you couldn't go out.
Go up because you can't go out.
Right.
And so I'm sitting in Charlottesville now for 15 years, teaching over at the university, and I've gotten kind of curious. There are a handful of these early skyscrapers before, the Depression, and I got interested in what were they thinking? Where did these things possibly come from? Because there was certainly not the pressure on land that you found out in Chicago, and there was not really any compelling reason, the economic reasons, the land use reasons, that would suggest that we ought to be building skyscrapers in Charlottesville. So I started delving into this, and it turns out to be a fascinating tale because for several reasons. By the time that the skyscraper started being introduced to Charlottesville, people already realized that the keystone of Charlottesville's economic development was going to be tourism, history, and access to scenic resources.
They knew this in the teens.
Yeah. And Jefferson, of course, looms large in that. And so the question is, how, do you figure out that you're also, at the same time that you're celebrating historic and scenic resources, that the city is building an economy based on these modern forms that stand quite outside of the kind of Jeffersonian architectural heritage? It turns out that people thought they could do both. They could both have this incredibly historic, storied landscape, but that they could also get the rudiments of what was viewed as the most progressive urban form for cities, the iconic skyscraper that would loom over the skyline. And so you have, in the case of the National Bank building, this really interesting competition between local banks, and they're kind of balancing each other out, trying to get the most impressive building. And in the case of the National Bank building, which is now the Wachovia Bank building, they had just been sort of trumped by the construction of the People's Bank building, which is now Bank of America. Incredible classical jewel box designed by Eugene
Bradbury.
Gorgeous,
yeah, it's gorgeous.
And so what was the National Bank building to do, or the National Bank to do? And they said, okay, well, we'll concede the ground to you. We're going skyward. And they end up putting up Charlottesville's first skyscraper in 1920. And so there's a kind of competition that's about ego and about promotion rather than about the necessities or the pressure on the land. And that became an interesting first look. And then the second skyscraper is the Monticello Hotel, which went up across from the courthouse. And there, everyone in town absolutely knew that they wanted to build a hotel that would accommodate people traveling to Charlottesville to enjoy Jefferson and the local scenery. And yet they still wanted to reassure those guests that they were going to get the most modern accommodations that they could possibly get. And so what they did is they built a Jeffersonian skyscraper.
We're talking with architectural historian Daniel Bluestone, teaches at the University of Virginia, and he's the author of an article in the latest edition just released of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society magazine. You can get one at the Historical Society downtown on Lee Park, or you can hang on and we'll give away three copies here at the end of the interview. And you know, I was thinking as you were talking about the building of the Monticello Hotel on Court Square, the perfect union of this interest in history and Jefferson and yet the new urban look of the skyscraper is the fact that on the top of that hotel, they put this big, huge searchlight and pointed it at Monticello.
The Jefferson light. It's an incredible story that I had no idea until I started really looking into the deeper history of these buildings. When in 1927, a searchlight, the strongest searchlight in the world, 1.2 billion candle power, was mounted on top of the Monticello Hotel. And again, the notion was that this would attract people from hundreds of miles away, the new auto-born tourist who would be driving around the Virginia countryside would be attracted to Charlottesville by this incredible skylight, searchlight that would sweep the night sky. But the way that it was inaugurated was fascinating. They had the daughter of the president of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation standing in the city council chamber in New York City, close to the desk that Jefferson used when he was Secretary of State. She shined a flashlight on a portrait of Jefferson, which activated a Western Union relay, which came to the top of the Monticello Hotel and turned on the searchlight for the first time. And then...
I never knew that. That is great.
The searchlight flashes a beam onto Monticello, which triggers another relay, which returns to New York City and turns spotlights on painting of Monticello. So the circuit was completed. It's just this extraordinary, again, this combination of you know, communing with our 18th century founding fathers with this 21st century technology and this really high level effort to promote the economy of Charlottesville using tourism and scenery. It's extraordinary.
We're talking with architectural historian Dan Bluestone. So did it work? Did this effort to build these big new skyscrapers to attract business and tourists and in the 1920s, how successful was it, you think?
Well, it's always hard to judge this. When you're talking about skyscrapers in the 1920s, you're always aware that 1929 ended all of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that as a strategy for suggesting to people, and this is one of the things that local architecture does, and in fact, it characterizes a lot of architecture that goes up even today. A city and a city's business community is anxious to let people from the outside see that there's enough wealth generated in that community to build impressive, architecturally monumental buildings. And that's part of the strategy here. In the case of the National Bank, they want to show that they're wealthy enough and have enough resources, enough capital in their bank that they can build the most expensive building in town and that it can begin to match the architecture that you associate with major cities around the country. That's what the skyscraper did. Same thing again with the Monticello Hotel. And then the third in our triptych of early skyscrapers was the first elevator building in Charlottesville, which was the Altamont Apartments, which went up on the center of Altamont Circle. And again, fascinating, the way in which it was promoted was as apartment homes, and the frame of the houses along Altamont Circle provided just the right setting for people to overcome what had been a historical prejudice against apartment house living. And it was nestled in there amidst those buildings. It went up on the site of the historic Gilmer, Governor Gilmer mansion. And I suppose at that time, preservationists like me would have been all up in arms about the demolition of this earlier Gilmer mansion.
Right.
But you have to say that that apartment building is one of the nicest, most attractive buildings in Charlottesville.
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
In terms of its urban context,
it's absolutely beautiful, isn't it? When you
a
go
nice
up that hill,
balance.
And it's sort of out of the way. I mean, if you're
that's right.
if you can see the skyline of Charlottesville from a certain angle, you see it.
Right.
And you think, what's that?
Yeah.
Because it's sort of tucked out of the way. You sort of have to drive downtown and go up Altamont Circle. And
right.
as you head up the hill and see that building at the top of the hill, it is stunning. It's
right.
so beautiful.
It's a great building. And one of the extraordinary things about it, if you think about the efforts to have that searchlight sweep the sky and get tourists driving to Charlottesville, well, the Altamont apartment building had space for parking cars in the basement of that building. It was probably also the first multi-car parking garage for an apartment complex in Charlottesville at that time
wow.
as well.
Interesting that there was, we're talking with architectural historian Dan Bluestone. I find it interesting that there was a prejudice in this region against living in high-rise apartment buildings. Why the prejudice and how was it overcome?
Well, it's not just this region. It's really nationwide. You know, there was a lot of effort put right after World War I into promoting the own your own home movement. And we basically wanted people to become homeowners and to give up apartment living. And one of the assumptions is that people would, by living in apartments, wouldn't be willing to have large families. They wouldn't have the kind of ties and roots in the community that ownership would give them. And so there was a whole cultural prejudice about living in apartment buildings. And the way it was overcome, I mean, part of the argument was, well, you know, I don't want those deep ties, maybe, to the community. I don't want the burden of a mortgage. I want a place that I can relocate easily from, and that there are all kinds of efficiencies here where, for example, women who are beginning in the 20s to work outside of the home, they can't be around playing the role that women had often played maintaining and managing large households. But that was precisely the cultural critique of that, was actually that that women would start giving up their usual domestic roles in the home. And so there's a lot of very interesting debate about this.
Interesting.
There are articles, for example, in the Chicago Tribune at this time that note the alarming rise in insanity among women who are living in apartments. And what the assumption was is that they just didn't have enough to occupy their time. You know? So it's this sort of nutty cultural argument, but it is interesting. And there's no doubt that that was here. And if you read the advertisements that went with the original Altamont building, they never call them apartments. They call them apartment homes. And they totally emphasize the fact that it sits nestled in this single-family residential neighborhood.
Which it still does today.
And there's a great line that they use. They say, it's only minutes from Main Street, but miles from the hustle and bustle of the city. And they're actually taking advantage of the technology that gets people above the noise and the dirt of the streets at that time, and suggesting that they could actually transcend the very urban condition that that building was constituting, which is, you know, by definition, cities are higher density settlements. Skyscrapers are the highest density settlement you can have. And so there's this notion, oh, well, we're transcending the
city, very thing that we are, yeah.
That we are, that's right.
Architectural historian Dan Bluestone is my guest. Dan, this article couldn't be more timely because we have now on the books all of these plans to see Charlottesville grow up yet again with a whole slew of new, they're talking nine-story apartment buildings that would dot the landscape all right. throughout downtown. There must be half a dozen of those things. When the economy
on
turns
the
back around, right. they'll go right back up.
Yeah.
And of course, we have the new luxury hotel, which is the brakes are on that because of funding, it looks
right.
like, but it's still in process.
Right.
What are your thoughts, given this historic context, for what's going on now?
Well, it's actually, in some ways, it's a very interesting challenge to the way in which we think about building. And as you know, there have been debates about these high-rise buildings. And I think the first inclination of many people is to say, whoa, this is a historic territory. This is a historic district. We've got to be extra careful. And I agree with that. But one of the interesting things is that by the rules in place today, regulating through the Board of Architectural Review, say Courthouse Square or the Downtown Mall, neither the National Bank Building nor the Monticello Bank, the Monticello Hotel would ever have been built under the guidelines that we have in place today, or it would have been a really difficult thing. And one of the things that I find actually fascinating about this is the ability, the historical ability of the town to actually accommodate modern change in a historic and storied landscape. And what was fascinating about the Monticello Hotel is they really felt that you could go to nine stories, a form that Jefferson never could have imagined, but they could do it through design in a way that would be compatible with the Jeffersonian architectural legacy. And if you look at the building today, it's got these ornate cornices with dental moldings.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's got a
yeah.
base of arched windows that look like the West Range of the university. And that they actually thought we can both have our history in our modern city as well. And I think the importance of this is that part of the effort to go high-rise now is an understanding that there's a more sustainable way for us to occupy the landscape and the townscape that we have. And that is almost by necessity going to have us living at higher density than we do today. And the thing that I find reassuring about this history is actually the possibility that it's possible to both have our history and our modern and sustainable forms as well. It's an important lesson, I think, in some ways from what we are looking at.
Yeah, yeah. And we have an opportunity to add to the history just as they did in the 20s. We could add to the history now if we do it right.
That's right. And I think that's the challenge, is to really try to make sure that this is done well. Now, having said what I said, I'm not sure that the high-rise buildings that are being designed and proposed today have the kind of architectural excellence or urban interest that the buildings that I profiled earlier have. And that's got to be a struggle and something we need to think about. For example, again, I don't think any apartment developer today would build the Altamont apartments in such close proximity to single-family houses. They just would never take that site on. Because, you know, they think they need all, you know, hundreds of spaces under the building. They need to make all kinds of compromises. They want to have yeah. a detached building. And yet that is a great example of a building where the urban setting was done in a way that really increased its value and increased its importance. So the question is, where are the developers that can work with that kind of insight today?
Yeah, and imagination and creativity.
Right, absolutely.
Bring them on. Bring them to Charlottesville. Daniel Bluestone teaches architectural history and directs the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Virginia. He is the author of a new article in the latest edition of the Historical Society magazine, Charlottesville Skyscrapers. And we'll give away three copies right now at 977-1070 to the first three callers. Dan, thank you so much. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.